This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Burma was once known as an exotic Buddhist land with few of the worries of the 20th century. But it's now a failed state, famous for nightmarish 21st century ills. It has the longest-running civil war in the world, 60 years. The country is now best known to Americans as the home of the 1991 Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, who has been kept under house arrest. These are observations from the new book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma, by my guest, Thant Minh U. His parents are from Burma, and he spent several years of his childhood there. His grandfather, U Thant, was the Secretary General of the UN from 1961 to 71. And as we'll hear in a minute, during U Thant's funeral in Burma, his coffin became the center of a political fight between the government and rebelling students. Thant Minh U has followed in his grandfather's footsteps and worked with the UN in several positions, including head of policy planning in the Department of Political Affairs, and he served on UN peacekeeping operations in Cambodia and Bosnia. Thant Minh U, welcome to Fresh Air. Before we talk about your book and your life, I just want to ask you a very basic question, and that is, you're going to use the word Burma in our conversation, as you do in your book. Why do you choose to use Burma instead of the name the country was officially changed to, which is Myanmar?
Some people prefer Burma for political reasons, and they shy away from using Myanmar because it's the name that was given to the country by the current military government. But for me, it's more out of habit. It's slightly for aesthetic reasons. I think Burma sounds nicer in English. And also because Myanmar is actually an adjective in Burmese. It means Burmese rather than Burma. So as a Burmese speaker, it sounds to me sometimes slightly strange to refer to the country as Myanmar rather than Burma.
Well, your parents are both from Burma, but you grew up in New York and you went to Burma for the first time when you were 8. And this was for the funeral of your grandfather, U Thant, who had recently served as Secretary General of the UN. And shortly after he stepped down from that position, he died. So you and your parents went to Burma for his funeral, and his funeral became the center point of this huge violent confrontation. First of all, protesting students protesting the military government, stopped the hearse and seized the coffin. Why did they do that?
It was a way for them both, I think, to show respect for my grandfather, who had been an important part of the last democratic government in Burma in the 1950s. It was also at a time of rising inflation and, I think, rising anti-government feeling, and it was a way of protesting the military government at the time. It wasn't something that my family, had expected. I think we had thought that there might be problems, but nothing like what had actually happened. I think the student leaders were well-intentioned. I think they had wanted very much to have a fitting public burial and ceremony for my grandfather, but it turned after just a few days or a week or so into something much more violent.
What year was this?
This was at the end of 1974. He died in November of 74, and we left New York with his body to go to Burma a few days afterwards.
So the students basically seized the coffin and took off with it. What did they do with it?
The government had wanted, the dictator at the time, General Ne Win, had wanted as quiet a burial as possible. And they wanted my grandfather to be buried at a very small private cemetery on the outskirts of Rangoon. And this was seen as unacceptable by the student leaders that were emerging at that time. And they took the coffin with the body, and they had wanted to bury him at the site of the old student union at Rangoon University, which is where they were studying. And this was a place that had great historical value to Burmese nationalism. It was the place where Burmese nationalists had gathered and had made speeches and had organized in the 1930s and 1940s, and it had been blown up by the Burmese military government in 1962. So they had wanted to bury him and to create a mausoleum for him at that site. But quickly, within a day or two, it had turned from this student protest of several hundred, perhaps a couple of thousand students, into a much bigger anti-government protest that had attracted probably thousands, if not tens of thousands, of other people as well. And it quickly become probably the biggest challenge to the military government since they had taken over in 62, 12 years before.
Well, and then your grandfather's coffin became like a football. The military took it back. And then the students took it back again.
Well, the military, there had been negotiations that my family, my father, And my uncles, my great uncles, had tried to broker between the student leaders and the military government. And the outlines of what they were discussing was some way where my grandfather would be buried in a public mausoleum, that there would be some sort of public ceremony, and there would be amnesty for the student leaders who had started all this. But those talks then broke down after a few days, and the government then lost patience and forcefully took the body back in a pre-dawn raid on the university that left many students dead. We don't know exactly how many. And that in turn touched off fairly widespread rioting and violence throughout the capital and the imposition of martial law.
So where was your grandfather finally buried?
He was finally buried at the foot of the Shwedagon Pagoda, which is the most holy site in Burmese Buddhism. And this was the place that had been discussed between the students and the government and my family during those few days of very tense negotiations. So I remember we were staying at a hotel on the outskirts of Rangoon, and we were phoned, or my parents were phoned, very early in the morning, and my father had to go out. The government had told him that they had seized the coffin back. They showed him and my great uncles my grandfather's body so that they could be witness to the fact that he was now being reburied at this new site. But we only learned later in the day of the violence that had taken place at the university just that morning, when dozens of students had tried to protect the coffin to the very end and were probably killed, gunned down by the government forces who took over the campus at the time.
Well, after your grandfather's funeral, your family was told to leave the country. But you and your parents moved back to Burma when you were how old?
Well, we moved to Bangkok when I was 12 years old. And I went to school in Thailand, but we spent most of our summers, or many of our summers and other holidays, in Rangoon. So I spent a lot of my time between 12 and 17 living in Thailand, but traveling very often to Burma and spending summers there.
In 1988, you went to live in a Burmese rebel base camp. What was the camp and what were you doing there?
In July of 1988, there had already been some sporadic anti-government demonstrations, mainly in Rangoon. And these were starting to grow in both size and intensity. But it was only in the beginning of August 1988 that they became something like a real challenge to the military dictatorship. And the demonstrations grew into tens of thousands of people taking to the streets. And the military dictator at the time, General Ne Win, in an unprecedented speech to his own political party, said that Burma should perhaps consider a return to a multi-party, meaning a more democratic form of government. And this only energized the demonstrations, and soon hundreds of thousands of people were taking to the streets. I was at the time working as an intern with the UN in Geneva, and I, like everyone else of my generation, I was 22 then, was very excited by the prospects of some sort of revolution or revolutionary change in the country that would make the country democratic and set it on a much better path to the future. But by September, the middle of September, these demonstrations were very brutally suppressed by the Burmese army, and at least hundreds of people were killed in Rangoon as a consequence. And thousands of Burmese students who had been leading many of those demonstrations left Rangoon and fled to the Burmese Thai border, which is a huge 1,000-mile-long border, into areas that were run by ethnic rebels who had been fighting themselves for autonomy from the Burmese government for decades. And all of a sudden, you had thousands of these students living amongst thousands of ethnic guerrillas. They weren't refugees. They weren't necessarily fleeing because they were afraid of what was going to happen next in Rangoon. There was an element of that. But they were hoping that they could regroup, that they could get arms and support, perhaps from the United States or from others. Perhaps they could get training from some of these ethnic rebels, and then they would go back and fight the Burmese government, who had just killed dozens of or hundreds of their friends and colleagues. And I couldn't get back to Burma in time for the demonstrations in August. I was trapped in Bangkok because the airport was shut down at the very beginning of September. But when the students, who were exactly my age, came out to the border and were in the string of these jungle camps for weeks, I immediately went there and met many of them. I stayed there for several months, on and off, over late 1988 and 89. And many of them were interested again in a sort of violent overthrow of the government and training to be soldiers to overthrow the government. I was there because I think I shared with them their analysis of what had happened. I shared with them a desire to see political change. But in the end, I didn't share with them their sense that a violent revolution starting with an insurgency on the border was the answer.
So I eventually left. Why didn't you think a violent revolution was the answer?
Because you had an army in Burma that was, even at that time, almost 200,000 men who were very much in control of the situation. I didn't think that anything other than a major power, the United States or some other country, actually in a Cold War style building up a huge army on the border would be able to topple the government. And even in 1988, it would have been impossible, I think, to get the United States or any other country, any other major country, to fund and arm the kind of insurgency that it would take to topple a 200,000-man army, which had been fighting. It was a very tough army that had been fighting for decades already. And second, even if it was possible to challenge the army by building up another army of 100 or 200,000 people, it would have plunged Burma into a very long civil war. I thought there would be other and better ways of trying to change things than that.
My guest is Thant Minh U. His new book is called The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Thant Minh U. His new book about Burma is part history, part memoir. It's called The River of Lost Footsteps. You know, in 1988, the period that we're talking about right now, the dictator in Burma, Ne Win, he believed in astrology, and apparently some of his rulings were based on these, like, mystical visions that he'd have, like deciding to abolish the currency and replace it with a new one in which all the notes were divisible by nine, and decreeing that the Burmese had to switch overnight to driving on the right side instead of the left side. Was, like, what impact did it have on Burmese culture to have, you know, a dictator who also thought he was having visions and would make these, you know, kind of bizarre changes based on that?
Well, General Ne Win, by the later part of his rule, by the late 1970s and 1980s, had become increasingly arbitrary, had become strange in terms of the policy decisions that he had made, like the ones that you had just mentioned. But he is, in general, a very enigmatic figure. I mean, I think he changed a lot also throughout his life. In the late 1940s and 50s, when he was head of the army, he was a very tough professional soldier, and he led the Burmese army at a time of civil war against mainly communist rebels throughout the country, as well as ethnic rebels. And when he took over in 1962, he instituted two sets of policies that have proven to be disastrous. One, he overthrew the democratic government and imposed a lasting military dictatorship. But second, he chose to nationalize all businesses, kick out all aid programs, and essentially isolate the country almost completely from the outside world in terms of trade, investment, tourism, and everything else. And in a way, some of these more arbitrary decisions later on about the currency, his dependence on astrologers from a lot of his decisions, were not as important as these really basic policy decisions that he made at the very beginning. He also expelled hundreds of thousands of ethnic Indians from the country in a very similar way to Idi Amin in Uganda not long afterwards. And that was also disastrous because the Indians in the country had been a big part of the business class in the country as well.
The protests of 1988 that we've been talking about is the time when Aung San Suu Kyi makes her first public address. And she, in 1991, won the Nobel Peace Prize. She was placed under house arrest before that. Why was she placed under house arrest?
She had emerged by that time as clearly the leading spokesman for the pro-democracy opposition in the country. She had always, I think, had a sense of responsibility towards the country, even though she had lived outside since she was very young in India and then in the UK and then in Bhutan for a short time. She was accidentally in Burma at the time of the 1988 uprisings, the time when I was in Geneva and then trying to get back into the country, because her mother was very ill and she had gone back to look after her. And during the demonstrations, a lot of the students, because they themselves had no clear leadership, many of them were carrying portraits of her father, General Aung San, who was a great Burmese nationalist leader in the 1940s. And they had tried to, they had encouraged her, as well as many other slightly older people, to join the movement and to help lead them, having taken things that far. And she gave a speech at the near the Shwedagon Pagoda during these demonstrations, and it attracted an enormous crowd, and she quickly emerged as a very popular figure. And after the government cracked down and ended the demonstrations in September of 1988, they did allow her and many others to form political parties. And her political party, the National League for Democracy, quickly became the most popular political party in the country. And her criticisms, not just of the military government, but of General Ne Win in particular, became that much more vocal. And she was put under house arrest, I think it was in June or July of the following year, 1989. But only after 9 months of campaigning, traveling around the country, setting up this party. And the government continued to allow her political party to campaign up to a point, though there was a lot of harassment, a lot of intimidation. And they held what were more or less free and fair elections in May of 1990. And I think to the surprise of many in the military, despite the fact that she was under house arrest, despite the harassment and intimidation that had taken place, the National League for Democracy won slightly over 60% of the vote and over 80% of the seats in this new assembly.
What's her status now in Burma? Is she still officially under house arrest?
She's under house arrest. She's been under house arrest on and off since 1989. There have been periods in which the government has freed her, allowed her to travel the country, allowed her to meet and organize her political party. And there have even been times when the government has entered into negotiations with her to try to find a political settlement. But then there have been many other times in which she's been under house arrest. She's now under house arrest and virtually cut off in terms of any sort of contacts with the outside world. There have been other times when she's been under house arrest but able to meet with family and to take visitors, but that's not the case right now.
Now, in your book, you say that you think that because she's so well known, it's kind of reduced the conflict in Burma to the good guys represented by her and the bad guys represented by the military dictatorship. What's simplistic about that?
There's a myth of Burma. And the myth of Burma is that everything in Burma is okay except for the military government at the top. And that if in some way you could peel off this layer at the top of army generals, then in general, in other ways you have a nice Buddhist society of that's otherwise at peace and that would be able immediately to govern themselves through democratic institutions. And that's completely wrong. Burma, since 1948, as I mentioned, has been at war. Burma is one of the most impoverished countries in the world. Burma, because of the military dictatorship over the last 40 years, has seen a complete withering away of all other state institutions. It's not like Pakistan or some other countries where you have a military government at the top, but then you have a civil service, a judiciary, other institutions. There's nothing to peel away. That the military is the state. So you have to transform that state. And I think part of that transformation of the state has to be through a lessening of Burma's isolation and addressing the central problem of a resolution of the armed conflict. I think the wrong paradigm in Burma is to think of it like to think of it as Czechoslovakia 15-20 years ago, where people take to the streets, there's some sort of uprising, the government gives away, and then you have a new democratic government. In Burma, it's that transition will be much more complex. So I think we need to take a much more complex picture of what's possible in the country right now.
You know, it sounds in some ways like there's a lot of pathology in Burma in terms of the leadership and the wars there and what has gone wrong. And it must be so much harder to fix a country, or to create a democracy in a country in which there has been so much pathology.
Absolutely. And I think it's two things which I try to point out in my book. One is a thing that happened very long ago in 1885 when the British first took over the country and annexed it to the Indian Empire, abolished the monarchy, abolished not just a system of government that had been in place for 1,000 years in many ways, but a whole court culture and system of doing things was sort of wiped away almost overnight. And so Burma completely lost its grounding in what had been a very long period of political and economic and social development within a certain framework for a very long time. That's the first. And the second is, you know, the decisions that the army took when it took power in 1962 in isolating the country. And it's very hard to understand from a place like New York or place outside, many places outside of Burma, of how damaging that isolation from the rest of the world has been in terms of the kinds of mentalities that have grown up and the ways in which people have been completely cut off from so many intellectual currents and ideas from the outside, as well as just the poverty that is, the economic poverty that has caused. So I think we need to think not in terms of a magic bullet or a quick fix or a grand strategy towards democracy in Burma. I think we have to have a very realistic appraisal of the situation in the country today and look at some initial first steps, both in terms of human rights and political change, but also in terms of economic development and humanitarian assistance, and in terms of ending the civil war, which has been, I think, the main plague on the country since 1948.
Well, Thant Minh U, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thant Minh U is the author of the new book, The River of Lost Footsteps, Histories of Burma. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.